Good evening. My name is Max Wayland, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, Dickinson College, the Penn State Dickinson School of Law and School of International Affairs, and the Dickinson College Department of Mathematics and Computer Science, I'd like to welcome you to tonight's event, A Perfect Storm in Cyberspace. The internet has been a tremendous agent of change in modern society, and often a force for good. Vast amounts of information are now easily accessible, communication across the world is effortless, and commerce and industry have thrived. But the internet has its downsides too. Crime and piracy have flourished, bank accounts are regularly hacked, private files are viewed, and copyrighted material shared, all this at tremendous cost. Naturally, governments want to bring the web under control, but the danger is that they overreach and infringe on the web's free structure. Tonight's speaker, Ron Diebert, is an expert on issues of cybersecurity. He's a professor of political science, as well as the director of the Canada Center for Global Security Studies and the Citizen Lab at the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. Professor Diebert has received numerous awards for his teaching. He's received the Carolyn Teo Award for Public Policy, and from 2002 to 2004 was a Ford Foundation Research Scholar of Information and Communication Technologies. Professor Diebert has published numerous articles, books, and chapters in books. His publications include Parchment, Printing, and Hypermedia, Communications in World Order Transformation. His forthcoming book is called Ghost in the Machine, The Battle for the Future of Cyberspace. At this time, I'd like to ask that you please turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. A question and answer session will follow this event, so if you have any questions, please hold them until then. And please join me in welcoming Professor Ron Diebert.
Thank you. Good evening. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Professor Pullman and Max, for that wonderful introduction. And all of the staff here have just been terrific. And I've enjoyed myself so far. And it's great to be back in Carlisle. I've been here a couple times before at the Army War College, and this is my first visit to Dickinson College. So I'm very glad to be here. It does not take much more than the scanning of the news headlines today to see how cyberspace is affecting our lives. A year ago in the Middle East, we watched as amazement as cell phones, Twitter, Facebook joined the lexicon of revolution as opposition movements leveraged these tools to overwhelm the capabilities of state security forces and overthrow regimes that we all thought were immovable, one by one, Tunisia, Egypt, Libya. After the dust settled, and once the secret files of these regimes were unearthed, a different picture emerged. Outsiders learned that the Gaddafi and Mubarak regimes had access to a much more sophisticated arsenal of monitoring tools, much of it supplied by Western firms. Tunisians and Egyptians have complained of a creeping return of authoritarianism and censorship and surveillance online. Tunisia's Islamists, for example, won a court order recently to reintroduce internet censorship, which was discontinued after the revolution. Supporters of the old regimes have emerged and have engaged in persistent hacking attacks and defacements of incumbents. A virtual struggle has emerged in the Middle East and North Africa as intense and dangerous as that on the ground. These new developments have complicated the simple narrative of Western liberation technologies versus authoritarian regimes. The last chapter of the Arab Spring has yet to be written. Within the group of 20 countries, the world's leading economies, every week brings revelations of governments, corporations, and individuals being compromised by malware, leading to loss of confidential documents, private information, and economic damages as computer systems are targeted by criminals, anarchists, and cyber spies. These attacks now target everything from banks and critical infrastructures to Sony's online gaming network. Whether these breaches are being done systematically as a covert and largely undeclared espionage capability, or the byproduct of the combination of digitally armed anti-authoritarianism and poor security practices, is difficult to distinguish in practice. Anonymous could be anyone. It could be us. It could be the government. We just don't know. Addressing the challenges that cyberspace represents is fraught with difficulties, As each of these events and phenomena throw up a myriad of policy, technical, and legal work that requires months, if not years, to understand and resolve. And yet the pace of events appears relentless, cascading, and continuously threatening to overwhelm and in many cases overtake policymakers at the national and international levels. If I said the term cyberspace 10 years ago, few in this audience, outside of maybe a few science fiction buffs, would know the term was invented by a Canadian science fiction author named William Gibson in 1982. But today, cyberspace is all around us. It penetrates everything that we do, think, and touch. It is our communications ecosystem, a technical artifact we have created that went from being a research tool to a new kind of toy to now a total immersive environment and a domain equal to land, sea, air, and space. It is the fastest growing communications media in world history, embracing more than two-thirds of humanity in a little over 15 years. We have come to see cyberspace as inevitable, constant, and always there. It's almost inconceivable to imagine the world before fiber optics, satellites, and cheap and always available 24/7 connectivity. We've re-engineered our business, our finance, our government, our social relations around new information and communication technologies. Governments the world over have banked on the information revolution. Billions have been spent bringing IT to the masses, even in the most disadvantaged areas, recognizing that knowledge and networking are essential components of development. Attention is now turning with extreme urgency to securing this global domain. States are asserting their interests, standards are being defined, and the results and the rules of the road, are being rapidly developed. Whereas once the promotion of these technologies was widely considered benign public policy, who could argue against it? Today, states of all stripes have been pressed to find ways to limit and control them as a way to check their unintended and perceived national security consequences. As policymakers struggle with basic definitions and concepts, there are at least three major issues to consider. First, the rules of the road are being written out there in the wild by actors who have colonized and appropriated this domain for their own interests. Today's generation of digital natives, those under 25, are driving social innovation of technology at rates that far outpace and outmatch the ability of institutions and regulators to adapt. Second, it is important to remember that cyberspace is primarily owned and operated by the private sector, as much as 95% of it, which makes it difficult to impose any kind of rules in a centralized, top-down fashion at all, at least not without enlisting the cooperation of businesses, big and small. Many states looking to control cyberspace are now downloading the policing of the domain to these private sector intermediaries of our communications. Third is the issue of change. One of the characteristics of cyberspace that differentiates it from maybe other media of communication in history is its relentless, constant changing nature. By the time policymakers get their heads around what needs to be addressed, new problems sprout up that were never imagined before. New tools of sharing, new means of producing data, new ways to wreak havoc. In our own research in the Citizen Lab, which encompasses several large efforts over the last decade, we have sought to take an evidence-based approach, outlining, defining the major driving forces shaping cyberspace and their potential consequences. And what we found has been disturbing. The thesis of my presentation is that there is a dark side to cyberspace, a perfect storm emerging on the horizon, reinforced by a multiplicity of disparate causes. There is a kind of ghost in the machine that threatens to subvert cyberspace and by extension the prospects and potential for global democracy as governments and corporations race to deal and cope with this dark side. What worries me most is not the problems themselves as much as some of the radical solutions that are being put forth to deal with them. Fear is becoming the dominant driving force for a wide-ranging movement to shape and securitize cyberspace. And it really threatens to subvert some of its core characteristics. In our quest to impose order over what appears to be chaos, we risk destroying the global commons of information we have created, potentially with negative, if not catastrophic, effects for governments, citizens, and global businesses. As Samuel Coleridge once said, in politics, what begins in fear usually ends in folly. Now, cyberspace has always been characterized by constant change, but almost imperceptibly, there has been major shifts going on in the way cyberspace is constituted as a technical medium that are fundamentally important and are changing the very nature of this ecosystem just within the last 3 to 5 years. The rise of social networking, the shift to cloud computing, and the rapid emergence of mobile forms of connectivity. Social media growth has exploded. 80% of all internet users globally under the age of 35 are users of social network sites and media. These digital natives have turned their lives inside out, sharing what would only a decade ago been considered intimate personal details with hundreds in their social networks. Now, social networks may seem like cozy hangouts, but they are in reality vast data accumulating vacuum cleaners that hoover every click and shared link, every like or status change, which are then processed and repackaged to advertisers, hoping to leverage that personal information to target their ads with the right audience. It is for this reason that Facebook's valuation is expected to reach, I think we were talking earlier, a mind-boggling $100 billion when it goes public today. Cloud computing has untethered PCs and networks by virtualizing these infrastructures. Data that used to be stored on our desktops and in our filing cabinets have evaporated into the clouds. This shift has lowered the cost of access to planetary computing, accessible to individuals and companies, but it raises significant issues with respect to jurisdiction of data, privacy, and dependence of individuals in digital walled gardens. Very few citizens outside of the United States realize, for example, that their data stored on Google servers, even those physically residing in their own country, are subject to U.S. Patriot Act provisions because Google is headquartered in the United States, and the Act compels Google to turn over its data when required, no matter where it is stored. For that reason, many European governments are now debating laws that will ban public officials from using Google or other cloud computing services that could put their citizens' personal private data at risk. Mobile. If the internet was the first technology to bring communication to the masses, mobile phones are doing the same to the global masses. But mobile communications operate along an entirely different ecosystem than the internet or fixed desktop PC infrastructures. Among other respects, they lend themselves to more precise geolocational tracking of user information. It is significant that of the 5.5 billion mobile phones in the world today, about 4 billion of them are located in the developing world, and demographics are key. There is a major demographic shift going on in cyberspace as the center of gravity moves from the north and the west of the planet to the south and the east, and the culture of cyberspace is changing as a result. While the West may have provided cyberspace with its original template, the West, collectively captured as the United States and Europe, makes up just under 40% of cyberspace. Presently, the Asian region comprises 44% of the world's internet population, which is the most by region, but it ranks only 6th in terms of penetration rates at 21.4%, meaning there's this enormous population yet to be connected, most of them young. Some of the fastest growing online populations are emerging from the world's weakest states, the fragile states, the failed states, for whom cyberspace is an empowering technology. Witness the colored revolutions of the former Soviet Union, for example, or the recent Arab Spring. While each of these upheavals has their roots in a complex mix of factors, including youth unemployment, lack of opportunity, income disparities, and so on, it's difficult to deny the central role of these technologies. The digital natives who propelled these upheavals were born in a universe of pervasive satellite TV, mobile telephony, and the internet. They were plugged in, switched on, and able to rapidly and virally network in ways that were difficult but not impossible for security forces to conceive of, much less counteract. So to understand how and in what ways cyberspace will be characterized in years to come, We need to think beyond the Beltway, beyond Silicon Valley, and into the streets of Shanghai, Nairobi, and Tehran. If the internet as we know it is largely a product of Silicon Valley and the entrepreneurship and the culture and norms inherent to that specific culture, we have to ask ourselves, what will the future of the internet look like when the center of gravity for innovation, usage, and connectivity shifts to the south and to the east? A third driver of change in cyberspace today, connected to the first two, is the explosion of global cybercrime. Now, cybercrime is not new. It's formed a kind of hidden shadow and an evil doppelganger to every step of the internet's long history from its very origins. But its growth has become suddenly explosive by any estimate. According to some security companies, there are around 80,000 new malicious software samples received every day in their databases. Every 1.4 seconds of every day, a new malicious software sample arrives. Botnets that can be used to engage in denial-of-service attacks against any target can be rented from public forums online for as little as $100. Some offer 24/7 technical support. Ever since the internet emerged from the world of academia and into the world of the rest of us, its growth trajectory has been shadowed by the emergence of a gray economy that's thrived on the opportunities for enrichment that this open, globally connected infrastructure has made possible. Now, in the early years, cybercrime was clumsy, consisting mostly of extortion rackets that leverage blunt computer network attacks against online casinos or pornography in order to frustrate owners and extract funds. But over time, it has become more sophisticated, more precise, like muggings morphing into rare art theft. It's become one of the world's largest growth sectors. Russian, Chinese, and Israeli gangs are now joined by upstarts from Brazil, Thailand, and Nigeria, all of whom recognize that in a globally connected world, cyberspace offers stealthy and instant means for enrichment. Now, the reasons for this sudden surge in cybercrime can be connected back to the previous two drivers of change that I mentioned. First, our expanding and constantly evolving communications ecosystem of extensive social sharing of data, mobile networking, and increasing reliance on clouds and social networking services has emerged so quickly in such a short period of time that organizations and individuals have yet to adapt proper security practices and policies. We just don't know what to do. While convenient and fun, this environment is also a dangerous brew and an opportunity structure ripe for crime to flourish. And so it's not surprising that we have this largely hidden and massively exploding ecosystem that is parasitically thriving off our insecure data sharing practices, our vulnerable browsers and websites. We have created a hypermedia environment characterized by constant innovation from the edges, extensive social sharing of data, mobile networking from multiple platforms and locations. It's like we've immersed ourselves and entrusted our information to clouds and social networking services operated by thousands of companies of all shapes and sizes and geographic locations. As I said, we've kind of turned our digital lives inside out in an electronic web of our own spinning, but have yet to fully experience its unintended consequences. There are, as I said, more than 4 billion mobile phones in the world today, most of them standard equipped to take pictures and videos, which you can upload to YouTube and Twitter and Flickr. Most users are unaware that many of these images contain metadata, that is, data about data, that is set to default to provide geolocational information about when and where that picture was taken, right down to the level of meters. This type of metadata can be extracted by anyone who views the picture and has access to some basic programs. Approximately 250 million tweets are posted every day. More than 29 billion have been created since Twitter's launch. Here is my dog. This is my place of work. This is what I eat for lunch. These are my friends. This is my phone number. Social networking has given us the age of auto-surveillance. Surveillance systems penetrate every aspect of our lives as people implicitly consent to the greatest invasion of personal privacy in history. Individuals can be mapped in space and time with a degree of sophistication that would make the greatest tyrants of days past envious. mostly as a result of our own digital habits. We are socialized to share through clicking, documents, attachments, hyperlinks. We click on website addresses and documents like mice clicking on pellet dispensers. And it is that conditioned tendency that cyber criminals and others can exploit with increasing precision. Cybercrime thrives as well, not just because of our social networking habits, but because of a lack of controls. It has elicited so little prosecution from the world's law enforcement agencies, it makes one wonder if a de facto decriminalization has occurred. And so, not surprising, it's seen as a safe yet challenging way out of structural inequality by the burgeoning number of digital natives, young coders of the underdeveloped world. It has become one of the world's largest growth sectors. Just recently, the members of a criminal organization that was engaging in global fraud on Facebook, known as the Kubeface Gang, had their identities exposed by independent security researchers working cooperatively with Facebook. Kubeface was a persistent menace that reaped millions of dollars a year by luring unsuspecting Facebookers into befriending them and then downloading fake antivirus software onto their computers, which the attackers then commandeered to click on advertisements that made them money. And the Kubeface perpetrators went to great lengths to hide their identities, but even they cannot escape the digital traces and electronic signatures that everyone, even the most determined criminal, now leaves. The Kubeface gang turned out to be five men wearing expensive athletic gear operating out of a typical startup headquarters in St. Petersburg, Russia. Now, our research group was among those who had helped uncover the Kubeface gang. In our case, we turned over the evidence we'd accumulated to Canadian authorities, to the RCMP, but were not surprised when no arrests were made. Cybercrime networks succeed by hiding locally while leveraging a global infrastructure. Electrons may move at the speed of light, but legal systems move at the speed of bureaucratic institutions, especially across national borders. Living in St. Petersburg, Russia, the Kubeface gang might as well have been living on Mars, so poorly developed are the mechanisms of international law enforcement cooperation. The most concerning issue is the fourth driving force, the blurring of cybercrime, cyber espionage, and cyber warfare. As I said at the beginning, in the past 2 years, there have been increasing revelations of high-level penetrations against government departments, ministries of defense, economic interests across the major industrialized countries. What these penetrations all share in common is that their basic approaches, the tools, the tradecraft that they use, are largely indistinguishable from those used in cybercrime. My research group is involved in investigating several of these cases, two of which were published as major reports, the GhostNet report and the Shadows in the Cloud report. Our GhostNet investigation began with alleged penetrations of computer systems at the Tibetan government in exile and the offices of the Dalai Lama. We eventually discovered a vast network of compromised computers across 103 countries, focused mostly on ministries of foreign affairs, embassies, and other political targets that were compromised by the same culprits. The victims of cyber espionage were identified in both reports, literally span the globe, and include dozens of governments, international organizations, global media, and businesses. Among the victims of the GhostNet network, ASEAN, the Associated Press, the accounting firm Deloitte & Touche, the United Nations, the Taiwan Stock Exchange, the Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and quite literally hundreds of others. The attackers were able to compromise computers in the office of the Dalai Lama and all of these victims by means of social engineering techniques, typically by sending emails that are carefully crafted to entice the victims to open their malicious payloads. This is a letter received by one of the victims, in this case, the office of the Dalai Lama. As you can see, the letter appears to come from a sympathetic organization looking to provide support for a Tibetan publication. This is not your typical spam from a Nigerian prince or an advertisement for Viagra. It incorporates real details gathered by the attackers from open information or maybe previous compromises, giving the messages the appearance of authenticity. Typically, the victim is not aware, however, emails such as these contain a malicious payload. that once executed silently infects the computer and connects back to the attackers, who then usually install more sophisticated programs and instructions. And of course, what happens next is limited only by the imagination of the attackers. In the Shadows in the Cloud case, which was the next report, the attackers mounted their clandestine network by exploiting a wide variety of social networking and cloud computing platforms like Twitter, Facebook, Blogger, Google, and Yahoo Mail. And they use these platforms for the same reasons we do. They are convenient, cheap, and provide distributed resiliency. They allow the attackers to hide their tracks and anonymize their transactions. It is often said that dark clouds have silver linings. In this case, the clouds contained a dark hidden core. Because of mistakes on the part of the attackers and some very detailed investigative work, we were able to acquire backdoor access to their command infrastructure and monitor the attackers' activities, including being able to see who they were targeting, and most astonishingly, recover data that they were stealing. We discovered that the Indian government, and in particular its defense and diplomatic establishment, was seriously compromised. We were able to recover copies of more than 700 documents that the attackers had been able to silently remove from infected computers, including some marked secret, classified, and restricted. Among those documents are minutes of the Indian National Security Council Secretariat, details on troop movements and insurgencies, business transactions and proprietary information from Indian defense contractors, and confidential diplomatic assessments made at Indian embassies throughout the world, such as the Indian Embassy in Washington, D.C. The funny thing is we're still in possession of these documents because we're not quite sure what to do with them. For us, it raised some serious ethical issues as researchers at a university. How do we handle documents that we recover that are marked top secret, restricted, classified? What obligations do we have to notify affected parties, like law enforcement or intelligence agencies? In the Shadows in the Cloud case, we felt obliged to notify the Indian government and tell them of the breach of their systems before our report went public. We were able to set up a conference call with the Indian NTRO, which is their equivalent of kind of the National Security Agency. And we told the Indian official about our report and its findings and asked for guidance as to how to dispose of the documents we had recovered. He thanked us profusely and said, yes, I'm aware of who you are from the GhostNet report and the work that you do. And then he asked us something that still has left us in a bit of shock. He said, will you be willing to join us to attack the Chinese? We will pay. Of course, we said, no, thank you. That wouldn't be proper. Now, in a globally networked world, your vulnerabilities cannot just be a domestic concern, but depend on allies and partners with whom you communicate. And it's notable that in our investigation, we discovered that Canadian visa applications submitted to the Indian Embassy in Kabul were among the stolen documents, as were visa applications of nationals of 12 other countries. I'm pretty sure there are not many tourists in Afghanistan these days, but there is a NATO security mission, and so the theft of these documents was very significant for Canada. And it raises a larger issue. Public institutions have embraced these technologies without consideration of proper security practices. Now, the question everyone always asks is, who was behind the attacks? Determining attribution, who did it, in cyber espionage is extraordinarily difficult, because of the way attackers can hide their tracks and stage their networks of operation through commandeer computers in multiple countries. But as the Kubeface case has shown, even attackers make mistakes or leave digital traces in the ether of cyberspace that determine investigators can locate with precision. We were able to make a positive identification when the email address used by one of the attackers turned up in, of all things, an apartment rental advertisement in Chengdu, which is located in the Sichuan province of China. Our further research showed the attacker's IP address tracking back to the University of Electrical Science and Technology in Chengdu, which it turned out the University of Toronto had a partnership agreement with. And the attacker is a researcher based at this university and a well-known individual in the criminal hacker underground in China. So we had no evidence connecting the attacks directly to the Chinese government. And the main point here is that the growth of cybercrime is more than a persistent nuisance that slows down your computer. it has become a highly ranked risk factor for governments, businesses, and individuals alike, in part because of the awareness raised by our own reports like GhostNet and Shadows of the Cloud. The consequences of this threat vector, if you will, are going to be numerous, wide-ranging, leading, among other things, I believe, to pressures for greater state regulation and intervention into cyberspace, and even exploitation, which is a fifth driving force of cyberspace that I want to talk about now. Now, there is a sea change going on right now in terms of the way governments approach cyberspace as a domain. Whereas once the dominant metaphor of internet regulation was quote-unquote hands-off, today the dominant metaphor is one of assertion of state power and increasingly geopolitical contestation. States have not sit idly by and ceded the social and political space to network movements. In fact, their moves to regulate and contain cyberspace within national boundaries have been aggressive and increasing. If you live in the Middle East, this is what you're more likely to see. Building borders and putting in place controls have become the norm rather than the exception. One of our research projects, the Open Net Initiative, tracks internet censorship worldwide. And we've tracked a growth of the number of countries engaging in internet censorship from a handful when we started in the early 2000s to more than 40 today. And the moves to contain cyberspace are not all just passive, relying on building firewalls to block people from accessing information. In fact, our research has shown states have become much more aggressive using what we've dubbed second and third generation techniques in order to control the web, implementing harsh legislation, attempting to regulate content online by making it subject to old media and publication laws, engaging in offensive operations, including hacking opposition sites, using pro-government bloggers as a way of directly competing in the information space. Now, while conventional wisdom has long assumed authoritarian regimes simply would wither in the face of the internet, many show a resilience that belies the conventional wisdom. For example, in Iran, the so-called Green Revolution in 2009, we saw a social movement mobilize on the streets of Iranian cities, connecting through networks of support in Europe and North America. Many people dubbed this a Twitter revolution. And the demonstrations achieved wider support for their cause. They were able to exploit social networking tools to raise awareness. But the Iranian authorities took countermeasures aimed at controlling the very spaces used by the demonstrators, not just by censoring access to websites. They employed more offensive actions. The internet was slowed down in many cities, and there were periods where it was not accessible at all. It essentially ground to a halt. SMS messaging and mobile phone connections were suspended or jammed. Through evidence that has subsequently emerged, we now know that the Iranian authorities were able to get the cooperation of Nokia Siemens, the largest cell phone carrier in the country, who turned over user data to the Revolutionary Guard. Cyber organizers found themselves being targeted and arrested. What is happening now in Iran offers a clear example of the new generations of controls that are being exercised in cyberspace as the domain becomes heavily contested and seen as a critical vector of the exercise of power. Authorities have also assembled a pro-regime army of bloggers known as the Iranian Cyber Army that hacks and defaces websites and social networking movements of the Green, social networking platforms of the Green Movement. Even those outside of the country have not been immune. Families of protesters have found their activities monitored, their websites watched. Part of the effort involves tracking the Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube activity of Iranians around the world and identifying them at opposition protests abroad. While it may have been once true to suggest Iranian authoritarian countries were too slow and plodding to deal with the flood of information, today the opposite is the case. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard uses a Facebook-type site in order to take down opposition. In other words, states are adopting repression 2.0 just as quickly as activists are moving in the opposite direction. Now, it would be a mistake to see these trends as solely an authoritarian phenomenon. The reality is much more complex. The norms of cyberspace controls are being driven and legitimized just as much by liberal democratic countries as others. For example, the United States and many other countries have stood up within their armed forces cyber commands and talk openly now about fighting and winning wars in this domain. We are witnessing a classic arms race dynamic in cyberspace that other domains have witnessed. But this time, the domain is something that we have created. It is our public space for engagement, communications, commerce, and education, which is now becoming ground zero for the Pentagon, the FSB of Russia, and the Revolutionary Guard of Iran. Not surprisingly, there is a massive and growing cybersecurity industrial complex that serves these growing pressures to securitize cyberspace, now estimated to be anywhere between $80 and $150 billion annually. Over the years, we have uncovered that many of the countries who censor the internet rely on products and services developed by Western manufacturers. Smart Filter in Iran in 2005, Fortinet in Burma in 2006, WebSense in Yemen, Tunisia, and the United Arab Emirates in 2008 and 2009, all companies headquartered in Silicon Valley. In part because of the awareness raised by our reports, one of these companies, WebSense, has just recently issued a new directive whereby they will no longer sell their products and services to regimes that violate human rights. And of course, we applaud their stand. Another recent report of ours identified that devices manufactured by Bluecoat, an American company, were being used in Burma and also in Syria, not only to censor, but to isolate and identify particular types of communication traffic associated with pro-democracy activists. We have also published several reports that detail how a Canadian company, NetSweeper, sells censorship products and services to ISPs in Yemen, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. This is a Guelph-based Canadian company that blocks access to human rights information, news, gay and lesbian information, and information critical of the regimes. But our research has only picked at the surface of a major field. Products that provide advanced deep packet inspection, content filtering, social networking mining, cell phone tracking, and even computer network attack capabilities are being developed by US, Canadian, and European firms and marketed worldwide to regimes seeking to limit democratic participation, isolate and identify opposition, and infiltrate meddlesome adversaries abroad. Now, taken together, these driving forces that I've described, I believe are threatening to subvert cyberspace's core characteristics. What was once a domain characterized by openness and the free exchange of ideas is being radically shaped by an increasingly intense geopolitical contest. And there's a real risk of a perfect storm erupting out of these driving forces that threatens to subvert it altogether, either through overreaction, a spiraling arms race, the imposition of heavy-handed controls, or through partition and cantoning as communities seek security through walled gardens. How could this happen? Throwing out the baby with the bathwater. It can happen here. Information controls are subtle, but their long-term effects and the standards they set worldwide are significant. Politicians tend to be ill-prepared and do not recognize the risks of band-aid solutions, such as implementing crude pornography filters that end up collaterally filtering access to women's health information while legitimizing the norm of internet censorship. You could say the very same thing about SOPA and PIPA. Misrecognizing the planetary politics of contestation. These are not just states or criminal networks. They are social movements that share certain commonalities. Whether it's anonymous, the colored social revolutions of the former Soviet Union, or the youth of the Arab Spring, politics are entering into a new, common, and heavily compressed space. Many of the groups we may applaud use the same techniques, the same methods of those we may abhor and want to outlaw. In an effort to deal with the latter, we have to be careful not to undermine the former at the same time. WikiLeaks and Anonymous, in other words, may just be the trade-off we have to accept, an inconvenient malaise that is part and parcel of the acceptance of an open, distributed commons of information. Over-securitizing the internet, risk cantonizing it and changing it in constituent ways. There is a real danger that an attempt to control usage and ultimately users, securitization may put at risk not just the positive benefits of networking, but actually the integrity of cyberspace itself as it becomes more cantonized and controlled along linguistic, national, and political lines. Paradoxically, in the urgent desire to deal with threats, we may end up killing the internet in order to save it. Cyberspace, as we know it today, is a unique human-made domain that emerged largely without the involvement of nation-states. It exists as a de facto common area, a mixed public-private space that for the last 15 years has been able to exist as if borders and state sovereignty did not matter. But they do. The danger is that as we seek to develop rules to make this space more predictable, we risk diminishing it, or even disrupting or destroying that which has emerged over the last 20 years. As we move forward to a more regulated cyberspace, transparency and accountability are going to be critical, especially as public institutions are ill-prepared and many of the issues shaping the global governance of cyberspace are complex and, as a result, difficult for politicians to grasp. The slope between good intentions and the road to hell is a slippery one. Countering terrorism online becomes a means of silencing legitimate opposition. Filtering inappropriate content or copyright violations suddenly becomes the basis for removing opposition and human rights websites. The issues involved are mind-bogglingly complex, and yet we stand at the precipice of deciding whether the future of this global communication system will be one that continues to evolve into a commons, a commonwealth, that empowers us all by making possible the free flow of knowledge, ideas, and capital, or whether it is parceled up, gated, and otherwise turned into walled gardens by a confluence of economic, religious, and political interests. The whole human memory can be, and probably in a short time will be, made accessible to every individual. It need not be concentrated in any one single place. It need not be vulnerable as a human head or a human heart is vulnerable. It can be reproduced exactly and fully in Peru, China, Iceland, Central Africa, or wherever else seems to afford an insurance against danger and interruption. These are not my words. They were written more than 70 years ago by H.G. Wells in his essay, The World Brain. Imagine if Wells were alive today to see how close we have come to achieving that dream, only to allow it to slip into chaos. We have indeed created a kind of world brain. The problem is that it is a typically aggressive, insecure, and all too human one. Thank you very much.
We will now begin tonight's question and answer session. Before we begin, I just wanted to inform you of a change in tonight's program. The panel on the bird food will be in the Anita Tuven Schlechter Auditorium and not the Stern Center Great Room. So we'll now take questions. Please raise your hand. The microphone will be brought to you.
Dr. Diebert, thanks for a great presentation. It seems to me that a lot of the things you talk about in terms of cybersecurity come right back on to the education of the operator. And that the operator, if they are appropriately educated, whoever is using the internet, can do a lot to stem some of the issues that you describe here. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because we often take the human out of the equation, and we only talk about the technology.
Sure. I think you're right, in part. Definitely a lot of the problems that my colleagues and I have identified are the result of social practices that have just sprouted up in the last few years and poor forward thinking about security at an organizational level. And I think that's understandable because if you think about the way we communicate, just within the last decade, how much has changed. I can remember not that long ago, I'm not a very old person, being in my office, and most of my files and most of my books were what I consulted, and they were within my office space. And now it doesn't matter what I use. These things are almost disposable because all of my documents are up on servers that are located in jurisdictions that I don't even know about. So the way in which we communicate today, I think, is an important factor, and there needs to be a greater ethic of responsibility and stewardship at all levels. But part of it has nothing to do with the user, with the operator, so to speak. There are policy changes that are happening. There are new business models that have emerged, like Google, Facebook, social networking platforms, that are creating incentives for people to do certain things that I think also are creating vulnerabilities and insecurities and political problems and policy challenges. And then above and beyond that is the fact that, and probably it's inevitable, that as cyberspace, as global communications has penetrated our lives, governments invariably have to react and regulate it, especially when it becomes critical infrastructure. And that's really the issue here, the core concern. Once something rises to the level of a security issue, someone was mentioning today that I think it was it Mueller that ranked cybersecurity as number one issue facing the United States today, in his opinion, over nuclear weapons and terrorism. That places it in a different category. And what I get most concerned about is that the baby will be thrown out with the bathwater. And then that's just putting aside, looking at one country, putting aside all of the other countries out there that are securitizing cyberspace for much different reasons than liberal democratic countries are. And that's where the future of cyberspace is, in those countries. They're going to be setting the standards and the norms in the future.
You talked a lot about single countries attempting to securitize the internet. Do you have anything to say about ACTA?
Yeah, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, for those people who don't know about it, is part of a long list of laws, treaties, regulations that are being developed by countries to deal with copyright infringement. To me, I think these are highly problematic solutions to a serious problem. I think they're the wrong tool, a blunt instrument, for a problem that does exist. I think that the entertainment industry, the music industry, the movie industry, the film industry is fundamentally challenged by digital technologies. But they are approaching the problem in a way that is not innovative, and instead is actually making the problem worse. So in the case of ACTA, for example, what is being required is for internet service providers, telecommunication companies, to take responsibility for essentially policing content on their networks. That may sound like a reasonable solution to some of these issues. We see piracy going on, people trading pirated movies and so on over peer-to-peer networks and over social networking forums. But what's problematic is the putting aside that it may not even work, is the precedent it sets. So if private sector actors are asked to police the internet here in the United States or in Canada for copyright violations, we can't then turn around to other countries like China, India, Iran, others, and say, well, you can't ask Nokia Siemens to turn over information on dissidents because that's a human right violation. And they'll point to our practices and say, well, you're doing it for a different set of reasons. Why is it okay for you to do it? And that to me is the most problematic part of it. I think it's an ineffective way to deal with a serious problem.
We have a question over in the side room.
There are people there.
Thank you for your presentation. I feel like running home and turning off my computer. Several years ago, I participated in a discussion where the focus was, how are we going to solve this security problem by developing something called Internet 2? A few years later, Internet 2 was launched, and it didn't take but maybe 10, 15 minutes. Somebody says, yeah, they've already got it. Is there an effort now to redesign the protocols and the hardware or whatever to design or redesign the Internet so that we can, in fact, have a secure cyberspace?
Yeah, there definitely are. Engineers are looking into new ways to secure the domain name system, for example, that I think are very interesting. There's IP version 6 coming, which is going to replace IP version 4. That may have some security implications, maybe not in a direction that I'm in favor of necessarily. I think the bottom line about proposals that are made, like the ones that you talk about, Internet 2, or maybe a green internet versus a Wild West internet, is that the same problems that plague the existing internet will no doubt plague the new internet that we create, unless it's a completely different technology. The innovation that sets the internet apart is its distributed nature, that there's a very basic common protocol, and you can connect any device to it and communicate with someone else on that network as long as you follow that basic common protocol. But of course, the design wasn't built for security, and we're facing now all of the consequences of it. I tend to think that the solutions to the problems of security are more obvious and less severe than some of the proposals people make. In fact, the answer lies in the internet itself and its distributed character. There are, as my friend Jonathan Zittrain likes to say, generative solutions for the problems of a generative internet. For example, there have been some recent takedowns of botnets that were plaguing the internet, tens of thousands of commandeered computers. The most successful recent cases involved cooperation of security researchers in many different countries sharing information almost at the edges of the network rather than through some kind of centralized enforcement of something. And I think in the future that's the way we have to think about security online, is through distributed mechanisms that are faithful to an open internet and don't really overturn its fundamental architecture.
The example of web filtering that you showed us was a rather blatant one. The government basically saying you're not allowed to go there, period. Is that sort of the norm now, or are governments still trying to disguise the filtering that they're doing a little bit more than that?
It's a good question. First of all, the number of countries that require internet service providers to filter the internet, to censor the internet, has grown, as I said in my presentation, from Saudi Arabia, China, and so on, to about 45 countries now. And unfortunately, most of them are becoming increasingly opaque about it. So there are some where you see these funny screenshots, which are essentially error pages that come back to you saying, you can't access this content because it's banned for this reason. Some of them actually put the law down. They say, it's a violation of this particular law. In Saudi Arabia, they actually have a form you can fill out. If you do not agree that this should be filtered, send in, a complaint. I don't know how many people do that. I wouldn't recommend to do that. But in many other parts of the world, you just get an error message or some kind of network connection problem. And it's hard to determine what's the problem. Why can't I access this content? To me, that's the biggest, most egregious example of a dangerous trend. Censorship, I think, is worse. It's at its worst when people don't realize they're being censored. They don't even know what's denied to them. And unfortunately, that's happening far too often, and in a more refined fashion. So the companies that I mentioned, the WebSense, SmartFilter, and so on, part of their job, what their service offerings include, are pre-categorized lists of the entire internet, as much as they can do that. So they categorize web content into things like religious movements, political opposition sites, dating sites, pornography, and so on, making it easy and efficient for regulators to check off whole categories of content. The Canadian company that I mentioned, even in spite of the fact that our report was front page news in Canadian media, this is a Canadian company, you know, censoring human rights information in Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. They say quite openly on their website, yes, we do that. We provide services to governments that have tricky political issues. But they do it in a way that's often a kind of subterfuge. And generally speaking, this is, I think, an overall trend, not just in censorship. For example, many countries are requiring mobile phone operators, telecommunication companies to put in place mechanisms to share their data with law enforcement and intelligence. In my country, there is legislation that's going to go through Parliament, because we have a majority government now in Canada, that will set up a requirement along those lines, but do so without any judicial oversight. So the police can go directly to the internet service provider and say, I want customer information, the ID of the mobile phone, the IP address, and all sorts of information without any court order, without a warrant. I was part of a panel recently saying, you know, if this is happening in Canada, we have no moral basis to condemn it when it goes on in Egypt or in Iran. And it is going on. Research in Motion, the maker of BlackBerry, has been dogged by countries, one after the other, the United Arab Emirates, Indonesia, and others, to put in place back doors. Research in Motion has resisted. They say, in fact, it's impossible on their enterprise-level services. I don't know whether to believe them or not. But again, there's an issue of, well, when I'm using this technology, with whom is my data being shared? And the same applies to all of the social networking sites. Most people don't look at those end-user license agreements or terms of service. They just say, I accept. And can you blame them? I mean, you need a legal degree to go through volumes, pages of information to get to the I accept button. And even if you read it, would you understand it? I looked recently at my own internet service provider's policy. I use this as an example all the time. There's a clause in my internet service provider's policy. It says, we reserve the right to share your data with any third party in any country of our choosing. Really? You know? So all of my email, all of my searching, you know? Think about that with respect to Facebook. I know a lot of young people in the room here use Facebook. I don't want to scare anybody off of technology, but I think there is, and maybe this gets at Dennis's point, an ethic, a civic ethic that is required, especially for young people today, to lift the lid on the technology. Find out what goes on beneath the surface. In the European Union, there are stronger privacy laws. You can actually make a request to a company, a telecommunications company, a social networking company, and say, give me all of the data that you collect about me. That's something you can't do here in the United States. So there was a German researcher who said, okay, I'm going to try this. I'm going to make a petition to Facebook. They gave him reams of information that they had collected on him. And it was astonishing. You can Google this and look at what was sent to him in a CD. Every like that he made, every invitation that he received to a party, every person that he's befriended, every friend request that he's received, even those that he did not accept, every tag that's been made, information about his computer, what browser he uses, what operating system he uses, what time zone that he is in, all of that information is stored by Facebook. Okay? Now, if Facebook operates in multiple national jurisdictions, and there are governments that have no process of judicial oversight or accountability, what is happening to your personal information? Who has control of it? These images and tweets and so on don't just go off into the ether. They exist on computers that reside in some national jurisdiction somewhere and subject to the laws of those jurisdictions.
We have time for two more questions.
Hi. I am a local school board member, and with the move toward e-books and things like ScholarPort that are hoping to integrate things like Wikipedia and iTunes U and Facebook and Twitter and all of them, what are the ramifications and the responsibilities for people in education because of the perfect storm you're predicting?
Well, I think educational institutions not just post-secondary, but all educational institutions. And I think especially colleges and universities in liberal democratic countries have a responsibility, a duty, to expose the extent to which our basic human rights are being encroached upon right now and are under threat because of the changes that I've described here. And, you know, I've always looked as a professor being in an extraordinarily fortunate position. I have tenure. I have academic freedom. It's a great job. I never thought when I was growing up, man, I have a job where I got no boss and no one can fire me. I've got academic freedom. It's great. No one can tell me when to go into my office, and I could wear pajamas all day if I wanted to. But there's a serious side to it, which is that I have a responsibility to speak truth to power. And I think universities have a special role to play, which is why with one of the projects, the Open Net Initiative, we've tried to develop a consortium, a network of university-based researchers in countries around the world to essentially create a kind of distributed monitoring system of people in many different disciplines, computer scientists, political scientists, and so on, who will act as gatekeepers and essentially guardians of those basic human rights as securitization, as the security agenda in cyberspace unfolds in each of their countries. That doesn't speak much to challenges that are faced in lower-level educational systems. There, I think the issue boils down to some basic lessons that I think need to be imparted to young people. I try to do this when I'm lecturing to my students, to have students think beyond their computer screen in front of them. I think when most of us are going through our daily lives, tweeting, you know, emailing, we don't think much beyond the screen in front of us. You know, we hear that whoosh and it's gone. And I like to do this, there's a show that my children used to watch. This will really date me, but it was called Magic School Bus. Do people remember Magic School Bus? So it was one of my favorite shows. And what they did in that show, for those of you who don't know, each episode is a cartoon. They would shrink down these students and their teacher in a magic school bus and then do things like go through the, you know, artery system or, you know, they would shrink down and you'd learn about things that were very small. And I think it'd be very useful if they had a magic bus school episode. What happens to your tweet? Where does your email go? It goes down the fiber optic cable to the router. From there, it goes to the internet service provider, to the internet exchange point, to the gateway. Every step along the way, there's an opportunity to either filter access to information or monitor communications. And those techniques, those methods, those capabilities are being put in place now all over the world with very little public accountability and transparency. And I think it would be great if there were a school program around that aimed at young people. You know, watch your digital trails as they escape your hands.
You said before about that German man who found this, who had received the CD with all of the information about him. This yeah. might be slightly dumb on my part, but why does it necessarily matter if something, if someone finds out your information about Facebook or something? Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, if they take your personal information of your bank yeah. account, but why does it matter if they know who you liked, who you friended?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's the question that's often posed to people who care about privacy. I mean, it's, you know, why is, I can understand free speech. I can understand access to information, but why does privacy matter? It really depends on your philosophy and your ideology and your social values. I do believe that privacy matters. I think at a most basic level, it's an issue about the limits on your own government and what they have a right to know about you as a person. And usually it's framed in old school terms as, you know, a property, you know, your home. The state has no role in my bedroom or my living room, you know, it's none of the state's business. And sometimes that's talked about in relation to the way in which a state might tax its people and intervene in aspects of private business. With privacy, it's often hard to make the argument that privacy matters in a kind of social context. But I think it's very important, more so than ever, to people, for people to have the feeling that they're not being constantly monitored, if for no other reason than I think it creates constraints around free thinking. And we need to encourage, as part of a liberal democratic society, if you believe that that's important, of all the political systems one could hypothesize and imagine, if you think that's the best one, for people to take risk, to speak out, to say things that might offend some people. And if you're constantly being watched and monitored, and every step you take is being recorded in some manner, that creates a chilling effect and a climate of self-censorship. That's quite apart from mistakes that can happen. You might end up in a kind of Kafka-esque nightmare because you have some association that you've made. You may have accidentally liked somebody who's, a felon or a terrorist, and this, ruins your potential for some job. Likewise, I think we need to be able to forget things. And this applies to a lot of young people. I have daughters who are teenagers, and I often think when I was a teenager, I would go to parties, and thank God, you probably hear your parents saying this, thank God they didn't have cameras when I was going to those parties. Yeah, thank God, because now you can Google, and that stuff doesn't go away. You may delete your Facebook account, but Facebook still has it, and that will exist forever. So the stupid things you do, you can never escape. That's bad as well. People need to be able to control what information about themselves is held by third parties, because they might not want that information out there anymore for legitimate reasons. Then finally, there's an issue about data security. There have been so many breaches in the last year of major corporations whose emails were hacked, passwords hacked. So when you're entrusting all of this information to these companies and their security systems get breached, which invariably they do, your personal information could get exposed without your consent. So for all of those reasons, I believe there, are... Privacy Commissioner in the province of Canada that I live in now, Anne Kavoukian, came up with this notion, privacy by design. She said this should be the norm for all manufacturing, all computer systems, all services online, that we need to design them with privacy in mind. And I am in full agreement with her on that. But it's a losing battle, unfortunately.
Tony Williams, I'm a faculty member here. This is not so much a question, but a suffix to what you just said, addressing the privacy issue. There are other aspects of that that are much more insidious than the ones that you mentioned. Governments worldwide spend hundreds of billions of dollars equivalent every year gathering privacy information for a wide range of nefarious purposes. What we euphemistically refer to as human intelligence, 99% of it is nothing more than privacy information utilized for specific purposes. And I suppose who uses it and why determines whether it's nefarious or not. But not every government in the world, as you pointed out, operates under judicial review. And private corporations spend billions collecting Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, privacy information, as part of their human resources efforts, particularly transnational corporations. And the information they gather is used to assess the potential employability of individuals at every level, beginning level all the way to senior executives. Employability not just based on whether you're foolish enough to or have the misfortune of having one of those parties that I also attended when I was young, posted up there. But comments you make, political comments, social comments, et cetera, are all weighed by psychologists employed by these companies in recommending to the human resources individuals which applicants should be screened out, because that's fundamentally what human resources departments do, is screen applicants out. Transnational criminal organizations gather privacy information for a wide range of purposes, everything from human trafficking to extortion. And this isn't just your bank account. This is information about your social relationships, your friends, your tastes, your behaviors on Friday and Saturday nights, what church you go to on Sunday, et cetera, et cetera. Most transnational criminal organizations, in fact, are managed and staffed by skilled individuals who know how to use this information to their advantage. So privacy, I don't disagree with anything you said, but I think there's simply the issue of security that goes along with it. And the security is often not well understood by users of the internet.
Do I understand that you think the best solution is a sort of a global, organic self-policing of the situation? If so, it sounds like something that's really unprecedented.
Yeah. Well, what we've created is unprecedented. We do have a global communications network. We can access information at a rate and speed that we never could before. Huge storage capacity. I tend to look at it in broad historical sweeping terms because I'm a political scientist but also a bit of a historian. And obviously when I look at the planet, I think most people share this view. I hope they do anyway. We share you know, increasingly finite compressed space. And we have many shared problems, you know, environmental problems, overpopulation, nuclear terrorism, whatever, biological issues. If we're ever going to solve them, we need a communications network where citizens, in an unfiltered manner, can share and debate ideas or solutions for that. To me, that's we've come close to creating that. We need to somehow maintain it. So we need to secure it, but not in a way that undoes all of that distributed capacity. And I think right now people are waking up to some of the flood of disaster stories and one thing after another, on top of governments engaging in an arms race. There's no doubt about it right now. We need to kind of calm all of that down and somehow find a way to solve the problems, which I do think can happen organically, as you say. Not solely, though. I think there is a role for governments. Regulation is important. We can do damage by bad regulation, like SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act. Terrible piece of legislation, in my opinion. Lawful access provisions in my country. Terrible regulations. My own government is absent in many of the international forums where the rules of the road of cyberspace are being debated right now. And that's a big problem because Russia, China, other countries with kind of territorialized ambitions have very clear, dedicated strategies to work through the United Nations and the international telecommunications. So we need the Canadas of the world to help your Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, articulate a vision of internet freedom, and that requires government intervention. So there are government policies that are required, but ultimately it has to come in a distributed fashion.
We have time for one more question.
Like, this is the intelligence room over here. These are they do, okay. Hi.
So I want to know what recommendations will you give to us as to like what things should we or should avoid in internet. Mainly, you were saying information that you already showed Facebook or any other network is going to be stored, and it's really impossible to destroy right now. But as from now on, what would be your recommendation?
I hope the lesson that you take away from all of this is not, I'm going to turn off my computer, like somebody said. In fact, the opposite. I think that this is a very powerful, it's empowering, democratizing technology that we've kind of accidentally created. It was never designed to be the infrastructure for all of commerce, all of society, and yet it has. So we need to use it. We need to use it responsibly, but we need to kind of lift the lid on it all, not accept things shrink-wrapped, and kind of question what goes on beneath the surface when you're using it. So don't stop using Facebook, but instead hold Facebook accountable. So what are you doing? Why do you need all this information about me? I mean, obviously it's because they have a business model. You know, you don't get all of that stuff for free from Facebook. Same with Google. The reason that they give it all to you is because they want all of your habits that they can then market to other companies who direct advertisement at you. Now, is that a fair trade-off? It might be, but at the same time, we need to hold them accountable for what they're doing, right? Same with your own computers. Why can't I use certain things in certain ways? You know, why do I have to sign an end-user license agreement that doesn't let me open up this CD and make it work with this? I mean, there is, and this is the last point I'll make, especially to computer science students, the term hacking has now become synonymous with criminal activity, when in fact, early on, it had a very positive connotation. It meant a kind of ethic of experimentation. Someone who is interested in taking things apart, like, you know, Steve Wozniak and the other original, you know, those people were hackers, right? Now, if you say, I'm a hacker, you might as well, you know, get put in incarceration somewhere or shipped off to Guantanamo Bay, right? This is absolutely the opposite. I say to all my students, you all should be hackers. By that, I don't definitely mean break any law. I mean be curious about technology. Think about what happens when you communicate today. Engage with that technological infrastructure. Explore it. Find out why certain things are structured in certain ways, and don't accept it at face value.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.